Support for KHOI comes from ISU Theater, presenting Iphigenia, a new telling of an old legend about the daughter of Agamemnon, February 23rd through March 4th in Ames. Tickets and showtimes at theater.iastate.edu.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Later in the show, we'll be talking with a professor in the Ivy College of Business at ISU about some very interesting research that she does on hierarchies in teams, and the findings of this research may not be what you think. We'll also be hearing from Heath Allen, the musician who will be playing at the Pantorium session at KHOI this week. And Keith Morgan from Story County Emergency Management will join us for his monthly segment. So please stay tuned with us for those a little later in the hour. It was a beautiful weekend here in Central Iowa, at least for people who like to get outside and do things in the snow. I saw plenty of people sledding, ice fishing, and snowmobiling, and I enjoyed some wonderful cross-country skiing yesterday along the Skunk River here in Ames. The combination of sun and snow and cold was perfect for skiing. And it looks like that will continue through most of the week. Right now, the weather predictions tell us that it will be sunny through next Sunday, but with no snow in the forecast. I know people who have to be out on the roads will appreciate better driving conditions than last week. Most days this week will be cold, in the single digits today, but then rising above freezing on Wednesday and Thursday, and then getting colder again on Friday and into next weekend. But it looks like we're going to see some sun every day.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah. You keep lying when you ought to be truthing. And you keep losing when you ought to not bet. You keep saying when you ought to be a-changing. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
That was Nancy Sinatra singing "These Boots Are Made for Walking." Somehow thinking about winter boots this weekend made me think of that song. Now, here is a summary of Iowa local news, as well as Iowa in the national news, during the past week, brought to you by the Iowa Informer. On Tuesday, Republican Senators Chuck Grassley and Lindsey Graham released a declassified letter. Grassley and Graham are both members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they had initially written the letter and sent it to the Justice Department in January. The letter concerned Christopher Steele, the former British spy who compiled the controversial dossier on alleged ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. The letter questions whether Steele made false claims to the FBI and whether the Bureau's application for a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrant to wiretap former Trump aide was based on inadequate evidence. Page was brought to the Trump team by former Morningside College professor Sam Clovis. At that time, Clovis did not notice that Page had caught the attention of the FBI in 2013 when Russian spies attempted to recruit him. The FBI began to surveil Page shortly after he was named as a Trump foreign policy advisor. Back in Iowa, a mid-year budget reduction bill passed Thursday in the Iowa Senate. This would cut spending from the state's general fund by about $32 million for the current fiscal year ending June 30th. The bill is intended to cover a $34.5 million state funding shortfall and includes significant cuts to public universities, the court system, and the Department of Human Services. Senate Democrats continued to oppose the cuts, although the cuts were about $18 million less than what Republicans had initially proposed. The bill will now be taken up in the Iowa House, where GOP lawmakers have proposed roughly $34 million in budget cuts. A bill sponsored by Iowa Republicans would ban all abortions after a heartbeat is detectable in a fetus, except for cases of medical emergencies. The bill advanced from a state Senate subcommittee by a 2-to-1 vote on Thursday, and it will now be taken up by the full Judiciary Committee. If it becomes law, doctors who perform non-emergency abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detectable would be charged with a Class D felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. The law could be unconstitutional and will almost certainly face legal challenges because of the precedent set in the U.S. Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision that a woman has a right to an abortion until the point the fetus is viable outside the womb. The News Media Guild is negotiating with the Associated Press over the company's recent decision to hike employee health insurance premiums. The Guild claims that the health insurance cost would eclipse the salary increases that the Associated Press has planned for its employees, including reporters, in effect negating their raises. On Thursday, AP Iowa State House reporter Barbara Rodriguez voiced her support for the Guild's efforts, tweeting, "I'm running around the Iowa Capitol every day trying to provide distinctive coverage for the public on behalf of the Associated Press. Yet my employer is offering benefits that don't seem to recognize that. Please give me and my colleagues a fair AP contract. We're worth it." And those were some of the news stories and Iowa in the National News from the past week. This was brought to you by the Iowa Informer. More information on these stories and more stories can be found at iowainformer.com. We have many researchers at ISU doing all kinds of interesting research. There were a few paper titles that really intrigued me. One paper was called "How Good Leadership Behaviors Can Hurt the Team," and another was titled "Status and Minority Expertise Signaling." So I sat down with the author of these papers to learn more about her work. I'm speaking with Marcia Schouten, an assistant professor in the Department of Management at ISU in the Ivy College of Business. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about your background.
So I am a recent transplant to Iowa. I'm born and raised in the Netherlands, where I did my undergraduate, my master's, and my graduate studies. And I moved to the United States about 3.5 years ago. First, was at a school in California for part of my PhD and was a postdoc at Michigan State University most recently for 2 years. And since this summer, I've been here at Iowa State University.
And you study social hierarchies in groups and organizations. So we should probably start by you telling us, what do you mean by social hierarchies?
So social hierarchies are really the way that members of a team or members in an organization are structured vertically. So how much power do they have? How much status do they have? How much influence do they have over the decisions that are being made in the team or in the organization relative to the other people in the team? And there are kind of two ways to think about social hierarchies. We tend to think of them as maybe more pyramids where a lot of people are at the bottom. And then as we go up in the hierarchy, there are fewer and fewer people, or we tend to think of them more as in the context of a team more often, we tend to think of them more as a linear hierarchy where one member occupies one layer in the hierarchy and we go up and up that way.
And sometimes I imagine those hierarchies work well, and sometimes they don't. Is that something that you look at?
Together with three co-authors, we just published a paper in the Journal of Applied Psychology on this precise topic, how effective are hierarchies in promoting team effectiveness. And we actually find that the greater the hierarchical differentiation in the team is, the less effective the team is. We find a small but negative relationship between social hierarchy and team effectiveness.
But you don't find a strong positive relationship overall.
In most cases. There is one exception when the task is very ambiguous, so we don't really know what we're doing, we're unsure what our role is, we're unsure exactly what the outcome is that we're striving for. In that case, it actually helps to have a hierarchy. So that is nice to have someone kind of telling you what to do and clarifying those relationships for you. But for things like coordination, we find a negative effect of social hierarchy. We find a negative effect when there's a lot of membership changes. There's a negative effect of social hierarchy on team effectiveness when the members are very come to us with unique skills. We call that skill differentiation. We also find that there is a negative effect when people feel that they can move up in the hierarchy a little bit easier. So we distinguish in social hierarchy research between very formalized, very static hierarchies and more informal hierarchies that are a little bit more dynamic potentially. And we find that particularly when hierarchies are able to change, then social hierarchies actually are very negative for team outcomes because they create a lot of conflict and strife between members that are then distracting and distract away from what the team is actually supposed to be doing.
I mean, when you say it makes sense, but it is counterintuitive.
Especially because we tend to structure our teams in a hierarchical fashion, right? We have a leader, and then we have a team members, or we think of ourselves in relation to other people, like, am I better? Am I worse than this person? Where do I fall along the social ranking? So it's definitely something that is very prominent in our minds. And it's also something that's very, very core to, the structure of a team. But we find it's not all that effective.
I think we have this idea that variety of skills within a team is a good thing because then there's someone who's good at this part and this part and this part. But if I heard you right, you said that when there's that plus hierarchy, that's actually not very effective.
Yeah. So what we think is going on here is that the team members don't really know why one person is necessarily above them compared to another person because they don't quite understand the other people in the team and exactly how they're contributing to the team. So in that case, you have a better functioning team if you structure it in a more flat way and everyone gets the respect that they're due, everyone gets the influence that they're due over that piece of the puzzle that they are contributing. A way to think about social hierarchies is as a potential coordination mechanism. So if I don't know what I need to do, mm-hmm. I can ask the leader or I can ask the person above me what I need to do and how I need to do it. So in that case, when, as I said before, where tasks are ambiguous, then hierarchies can help. But when you have alternative coordination mechanisms like this distributed expertise or what we would call it transactive memory systems where we kind of know what the other people should be contributing, then having a social hierarchy in that team is maybe too much coordination with the negative downside that often comes with hierarchical differentiation, that is a lack of respect for those in the lower positions.
And in some of your work, you also have found that people's identities, especially in terms of gender, might play a role in this. Is it too early to tell us about that work?
So this is some very early stage work that I'm doing where we're looking at whether people can recognize the expertise of everyone on their team equally. Actually, we know that people often don't recognize the expertise of members. So we have this idea that having diverse teams is effective. Actually, the research demonstrates that having demographic diversity, so differences on gender or race or age, isn't all that effective. And we want to find an explanation, first of all, for why potentially this might be, and we're looking at it more from a expertise signaling perspective. So maybe why we don't see demographically diverse teams do all that well is because we just simply don't recognize the expertise of our diverse members because we don't decode the expertise signals that they're sending because we don't accurately decode the knowledge that they're sharing. And we're flipping that on its head and trying to figure out are we actually sending the correct signals as minority members? Are maybe because of the stereotypes that surround, for instance, women, are we less likely to send clear expertise signals that are then harder to decode? One way to think about it as women, we tend to need to be liked. We have this very communal stereotype. We're caring, we're warm. And that kind of goes against this idea of competency. If you then, as a woman, want to share your competency and you signal that you are an expert at something, it's very hard if you have to then also balance the warmth, the likability. So you're sending very soft signals on the one hand that make people perceive you as warm, kind, likable, but at the same time, you're also sending, or you're trying to send more task-related signals that are about how expert you are at a topic. And because these are fuzzy signals, these are mixed signals, we think that part of what's going on is that we're just sending too many signals and it's hard to decode those signals as an observer. And that's why expertise does not get recognized.
So it's hard for the other people to get a sense of what that person could potentially offer because that expertise signal is mixed with other signals that are maybe associated with their gender.
Correct.
Does this lead you to believe that people can learn to do these things if they're aware of them?
So I think the start is always getting an understanding of what's going on. And then from that, we can maybe build interventions that can help women send more clear signals or help the other members of the team more effectively decode the signals, maybe through honestly just more patience, or maybe we should give more information in written form so that we take away the gender signal. But without a thorough understanding of why don't we recognize these expertise signals, I think it's going to be hard to have an effective and accurate intervention that can then help diverse teams be more effective.
And the other research that you spoke about earlier that just talks more about social hierarchies and some of the struggles that happen in them and the reasons they can be effective or ineffective in terms of getting work done. Are there implications that have come out of that work that people take into consideration when designing teams or planning how to accomplish work with teams?
So what I think our research on social hierarchy really suggests is that hierarchy is very much a double-edged sword, and you need to wield it very carefully. If you have alternative coordination mechanisms in place, like making it clear who has expertise in what area, for instance, and how they contribute to the team, maybe forego that hierarchy, except when it's a very novel, a very ambiguous, a very new task.
You publish in both business and management journals, but also in psychology journals. Can you tell us a bit about the overlap between those two fields?
Yeah, so I think that I would consider psychology and sociology both feeder fields for management research. Management research is very much, I would say, an applied discipline. We try to solve problems that actually happen in organizations. And in order to get a thorough understanding of what's going on, we draw from these insights that are provided by psychology. We draw from insights provided by sociology. But then vice versa, we also try to contribute to those insights in those specific fields. Maybe a good way to think about it is I see something happening at work and I wonder, why is this? And then I go and look in psychology, I go and look in sociology to kind of get an understanding of what it is that is going on. And then I use that knowledge to actually, within management, figure out what are realistic solutions.
And how did you become interested in this area?
I became interested in this because of things that I was observing around me. I was a competitive rower in college, and there was a lot of now I know that that was a lot of fighting about status and about the hierarchy and about favoritism. But at the time, I was wondering, why do we care so much about who is in the favor of the coach or who is in what seat? We're all doing this together, aren't we? And I was very surprised to see that, and that fascinated me. And then after some searching, I realized, oh, it's called social hierarchy. And it's called status, what's going on here. And that was where the seed of the fascination was sown. But it definitely, I see it everywhere around me. I even analyze people's marriages now by their power and status dynamics, which I can tell you is not a very smart idea. It tends to have a negative effect on my friendships, I find.
Right. Well, that is very interesting. It really is everywhere. So it's not just in business. And even in a team sport like rowing, right, you would think that's almost the ultimate team sport because you're all doing the exact same motion in the exact same direction to move the boat.
Exactly. The whole point of rowing is that you're copying exactly what happens before you, yet there is still very much a pecking order in the boat and also outside of the boat on land, at least what I found in my team.
You're a woman in business and management. That strikes me as being less common. Is that correct?
Yes, I think my field, organizational behavior or management more broadly, is definitely of the fields that typically make up a business school the most female-friendly. About 30% of professors are women. So compared to fields like accounting or supply chain management, finance, we definitely do pretty well there. But then management kind of separates out in what we call strategy research and organizational behavior. And organizational behavior is very much the psychology of the workplace. Mm-hmm. So what I'm interested in, and there are even more women. The interesting flip side of that is that it's also the lowest paying field within the business school.
And you also teach at ISU.
I teach human resource management. So I really try to teach the seniors at the Ivy College of Business about how to effectively manage their employees, how to select them effectively, how to develop or at least take the human element into consideration when it comes to developing strategy for the company, goal setting for the company. And I also am very passionate about talking about more development of employees. So how do you effectively give feedback? How do you effectively handle performance appraisal situations? How do you help employees in their career planning and career development?
And in that course, do you also talk about recruitment of diverse populations, whether it's gender or other underrepresented groups?
I can't help myself. Yes, of course. We talk about diversity mostly from the perspective of why do we tend to only want to hire people that are like us? Trying to give my students some vocabulary to counteract these tendencies and trying to explain to them how our brain works and how we bucket things, how we bucket people, so group them together. And then we start seeing them as a group member rather than as an individual and how that then ultimately affects our hiring decisions based on stereotypes. And I hope that with that knowledge, they can take away from that there is actually value in hiring diversity, if not immediately from a business perspective, from a profit perspective, definitely from a social justice perspective. And once we can figure out how to effectively signal our expertise and get it recognized, then having women in your organization that can serve as mentors, having racial minority members in your organization that can serve as mentors will all be very important to actually attract from a larger pool of people.
And how are you finding the change from first the Netherlands, then most recently you came from Michigan? How are you finding that adjustment to ISU and to Central Iowa?
It's been great, albeit a little bit cold. The Netherlands is on the sea, so we have a sea climate, and our temperature range is much narrower than it is here. And going from the 100-degree weather that we had in the summer and now the zero-degree weather has definitely been a bit of an adjustment. But it's been fun. I really like the fact that we have four seasons. Iowa is very similar to my province that I grew up in, where we also were the major producers of corn and pork. It feels like home.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your research with us and letting us get to know you.
Thank you so much.
That was Marcia Schouten from the Management Department in the Ivy College of Business at ISU. The Heath Allen Brand will bring its infectious music to the Pantorium session this week on Thursday evening at 7. The band is led by Des Moines saxophonist Heath Allen Patchell, and Greta Anderson had the chance to talk with him over the weekend.
Well, I'm here with Heath Allen Patchell of Des Moines. He is a musician who will be performing at KHOY this Thursday as part of our February Pantorium sessions. Welcome, Heath.
Thank you so much, Greta. Appreciate you having me.
You know, I'm glad that you were able to take some time out. This past weekend's been very busy for you, I understand. It's a big weekend for Central Iowa music fans and musicians, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sitting on the couch and thoroughly enjoying a little downtime right now. It was a big weekend.
We're speaking, of course, of the Central Iowa Blues Festival.
Yeah, the biggest, well, one of the biggest parties that they hold every year, and a ton of bands. And I work quite a bit with them, and I care a lot about what they do. So I plugged in a few different ways there, and we had a band that was supposed to play before us cancel. So we put a group together. Hey, is there a bass player in the house? Is there a drummer in the house? We piecemealed the first set together, but I ended up singing for 4 hours, so my voice is a little tired. If I sound tired, it's not because I'm disinterested. I'm literally pretty tired. It's been a big weekend.
Right. And that's just one of the institutions in Des Moines, Central Iowa, that promotes rock and roll and music and blues, obviously. There's all other less formal institutions like the Greenwood, and that's where I first saw you perform in Des Moines. Why don't you talk about the Greenwood and what it's like to play there?
Well, the Greenwood is a great place for people to get together for live music. It's small, it's intimate, it sounds great in there. And all the Des Moines musicians, or most of them anyway, hang out there and listen to each other and get ideas and exchange ideas and play together. So I've been playing there a couple times a month for, I think, 6 or 7 years now. So that's my home base. We can do a lot of different things there and bring new musicians in and try different material. It's a lot less formal and fun. It's a big family down there, and we're really lucky in the community to have that place, because we all kind of consider that our home base.
Yeah, that's what it seems like from the outside coming down there. For our listeners, this is a place on Ingersoll. It's really, you'd think of it as a dive bar if you just walked in, if no music was playing. There's a mural on the wall showing some dogs playing poker that must be, decades old, with this thick yellow patina on it. Some of the seats have their stuffing coming out of them. It's just remarkable. And then, you know, the musicians show up. The music starts, and you're just blown away by the quality of what you're hearing.
Well, thank you. We try to bring something special every time we come in there. It's always a unique thing with a wide demographic of people, very peaceful, and there to listen.
Yeah, and it's true, the way the musicians show up. We saw you show up one time for somebody else, for somebody else's show, and they kind of, roped you into playing a song or two. Yeah, I think Yellow Moon was the song that was requested when you were there. Because, of course, you were bringing your big tenor sax. Quite an instrument.
Yeah. I started out on alto as a classical musician, and that was really my voice. But when I started to get work, the tenor is darker and deeper and lends itself to a lot more situations, more handily. So I've kind of turned into a tenor player. It was good for me. I had to stretch out a little bit.
And you also play guitar and sing?
I usually play acoustic guitar. I'm more comfortable. And then we work with guitar players, electric guitar players, and it allows me to take up a different sonic space so that we're not fighting over airwaves.
Right.
I enjoy the instrument a lot. It's an electric acoustic, so you can plug it in and amplify it. But I prefer that sound.
Uh-huh. And so you, your biography on your website says you were sort of raised, almost steeped in the music of Des Moines and central Iowa. You studied with Bob Dorr and Joe Price. What were those relationships like?
Well, my mom's a singer, and we lived in Cedar Falls many years ago when I was little. And she was a bartender and waitress at a place called the Circle Bar. And the Circle is legendary for all kinds of great musicians that came through Cedar Falls would play there. And so she got to know a lot of the musicians that were coming through, and sometimes they would even stay with us. So they would have late night jams, and that's kind of how I made contact with Joe Price and Mother Blues and some of Patrick Hazel and some of those guys more from the Iowa City area. And I really was attracted to the sound that they made, American Roots sound. And so later, when Bob asked me to join the Blue Band, I had some connection with that music and blues music. I hadn't really been steeped in it before that time, but when I joined the Blue Band, Bob Dorr is such a wonderful teacher. I mean, even just because of the sheer amount of music that he has in his collection and what I was able to listen to and learn from through his radio show when I joined the band, honestly, I was a little overwhelmed that I wanted to fit in. So I listened to his radio show and I started to purchase albums and educate myself so that I would come and not make a fool out of myself. And then I wrote with Bob a lot, and I got to hear some of the stories of his past and spent about 15 years with the Blue Band, 10 years full-time, and then 5 years kind of off and on until they found, who they needed to hire after that. And so I learned a ton from all of those guys, Molly Nova, Jeff Peterson, and Sam Salamone, who's all a legend here in Des Moines, was also in that band. So just being around those people and listening to them and learning a lot of times what not to do, so it sounds good and it fits and it's appropriate.
So now you've gone from sort of being a side guy, you know, playing for a well-established band, into being your own front man, the leader of a band. Sometimes I understand your band can be as many as 10 pieces large. What has that transition been like for you?
Well, again, I have to really give props to the Blue Band because that was a pretty large band. A lot of times it would be 6 or 7 pieces, and learning from Bob how to navigate that and communicate effectively with the team was really important. I don't do 10 pieces a lot. It's a lot of work, but it's really rewarding. We just did it, a 10-piece band on Saturday night, and it was wonderful. It took a lot of rehearsal and, practice before rehearsals and writing out parts, but all that stuff's good, and I enjoy doing those things, but I couldn't do it all the time. But, I learned a ton from Bob and the Blue Band of how to organize just communication in general, how to get the best out of players and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. And of course we have to sadly bid that band goodbye of late.
Yes, but as individual players that'll go on, it doesn't make a whole lot of financial sense to keep that many musicians on the road there's just only so much money you can make as a professional musician in the region.
Right.
And they did a remarkable job for a long time, but five-piece bands, six-piece bands, quartets, trios, duets, down to solo, whatever pays the bills, honestly, is what we do.
Well, we are feeling so grateful that we're going to have three of you and two others, two of your friends, coming up to Ames to perform for our Pantorium session on Thursday night, 7 p.m. Tell us about who you'll be bringing with you.
Dwight Dario is an amazing percussion player. He met Joe Price, I think, in 71, was in Chicago, basically just moved away from home and decided that he was going to get into the music business as a kid, and got hired to play in the Mother Blues Band, which many considered to be kind of the pinnacle of the heart that, you know, a lot of things grew out of. Bo Ramsey, who produced Lucinda Williams, yeah, and has played with Mark Knopfler and done a lot of, you know, big things professionally, came out of that band, as well as Joe Price and Steve Hayes, who also spent time in the Blue Band. It was a kind of a nucleus band, and so he was part of that and a hero of mine growing up. So to get to play with him now is really special for me. He's just amazing. So he'll be with us. And then Krista Hoglund is a dear friend and a wonderful pianist that I've played with in a few different bands around here. And she, I try to hire her whenever I can. She's wonderful and just treats the music very purposefully and musically.
And how would you like to bill your music to our listening audience?
Well, I love a lot of different styles of music. I love classical music, but that's not really what I do. But I try to take the musicality that I learned from my education in classical music to just a broad spectrum of American music. So we'll do some swing. We'll even do some blues. This last show that we did on Saturday was all blues. It was a history of the blues show. So we started with Vicksburg Delta blues music from the late 1800s, and then we progressed up to modern, more rock type of blues presentation. We'll even do some jazz, and I like to give the listener a wide variety. I get pretty bored pretty easily with myself, so I like to keep my genres moving around. We'll have to see on Thursday what I bring. I haven't written the set list yet.
Well, we're really looking forward to this show. It's gotten a little bit of buzz on our Facebook page, so I'm expecting that we'll have a decent crowd. And, of course, it's free for them to come and for an hour. It's a 7 to 8 time slot, very strict because it's radio time. And we'll be listening to a couple tunes of yours, then chatting with you, and then going back to the music as we do during our Pantorium sessions. So it's always a kind of intimate experience where the audience gets to know a little bit more about the performer.
That was Greta Anderson speaking with Heath Allen Patchell of the Heath Allen Band, who will be here on Thursday. Don't forget to join us on Thursday, February 15th at 7 p.m. at KHOI. Listeners are asked to come early on that day to get a seat in our studio audience. If you can't make it here, remember you can tune in to 89.1 FM or live stream the music at khoifm.org, but you definitely don't want to miss it. We've now been joined in the studio by Keith Morgan, who is the Emergency Management Coordinator for Story County. Welcome, Keith.
Good morning.
Your email to me about what you were going to be talking about said the theme would be hazard mitigation. So I'd like to start by asking you what kinds of hazards you're talking about.
Well, this plan is something that's kind of required by FEMA, and they draw the basics that you have to have in there. So it starts with the natural disasters that we look at. For us, we know that severe weather, being the thunderstorms and tornadoes, snowstorms, items like that. But we delve even deeper. We consider things like earthquakes and landslides, which, although they don't happen around here, we at least look at them to make sure that we've considered any of the possibilities of those happening. Actually, southeastern Iowa is just on the edge of the Madrid Fault area, so they might consider it. But the key to these plans is that they're localized. They're designed to look at those things that are in the local area with local people who know those risks better than anybody else to try and catalog what might be out there.
And Story County already has a multi-hazard, multi-jurisdictional plan. Is that correct?
That's correct. And it kind of demonstrates why we revise it every 5 years. The last time we revised this, we brought Ames and Iowa State University together underneath the one plan for Story County. It started out that every jurisdiction, being every community, every school district might have their own, but they've tried to bring them together so that they're much more interconnected and useful. We did that in the last revision. And this revision, we're all going to be, again, under the same umbrella looking over this stuff.
How many times has it been revised?
I actually can't tell you the total number that we've had. I know that this is probably the third revision of it in its current form.
And what's the process for this revision?
Well, the process is to first off form a committee. We want public input on this, but we want this public input to bubble on up from the citizens and the businesses in the community to get together and to look over what they consider to be the greatest risk so that we can address those. And then it'll all come up together. This Hazard Mitigation Planning Committee will get together and compare notes between the different jurisdictions and make the inputs. We've actually got a contractor that's helping us out with this, and they're going to take all of these inputs. They're going to do some of the statistical analysis, and then we'll formulate that into a plan that looks at the risk, tries to quantify what that risk is. Then we'll develop strategies and then implementation strategies to reduce that risk.
And is it your office that coordinates all of this?
Yes, we try and bring everybody together, get them involved, and give the tools down to the local jurisdictions so that they can run this process at their level.
And what kinds of local jurisdictions or organizations are involved?
For these kinds of plans, for these jurisdictions to be eligible for hazard mitigation funding, grant funding, there is a requirement that every community and Story County Board of Supervisors taking the unincorporated areas, plus the school districts, to participate in this. If they don't participate, if they don't demonstrate that they've been a part of the process, then when FEMA has funds available for hazard mitigation, they won't be eligible for it. So that's why it's important that the jurisdictions get involved. But again, we want the public's inputs to put together a good plan.
And does FEMA funding, is that what's covering the cost of the consultant and this current revision?
It is. And without it, we'd have a difficult time being able to do it. This plan itself, over the past 2005 up to 2015, actually was able to bring in $4 million worth of hazard mitigation projects, such as generators or what we call tornado safe rooms for our schools, a place where all of the students can go to and be safe from a tornado. There's been some flood mitigation that has also been done. We look at buying out houses that are in the flood zone so that the people there have the resources needed to get out of that danger zone and into a safer place.
So once the plan is in place, you're saying that the groups that participated in it are then eligible for additional funding to mitigate some of the hazards that were identified.
Exactly. What they do is they take these strategies that they develop for hazard mitigation, and they, when it comes time to apply for a grant, they demonstrate how it directly goes towards their project, will go towards satisfying that hazard mitigation strategy.
So then it's really important that people get involved in this planning stage, because down the road it may mean other opportunities to improve the community.
Exactly. It is a tool for a community, but it's not the only tool that's there. We really want the communities to do this process and look at it, because there are other things that they can do that aren't going to require, depending on FEMA, to have some funding there. For instance, they can look at the risk that they incur with urban development towards or residential development near facilities that are doing hazardous industrial processes, and they can design their zoning to try and separate those kind of functions as much as possible. So there are those that do take money, and then there are those things that citizens and governments can do internally to make themselves safer and also safer for their citizens.
So tell us what stage this process is at right now.
We're about ready to kick off on February 21st. We're going to be having the formulation of the Hazard Mitigation Planning Committee. I encourage everybody out there that wants to participate to contact those that are in charge of, you know, their city clerk or whoever, to try and find out who's going to be in charge of it for their city, and to start putting their inputs together and say, I want to be a part of this, and get their name on a contact list. On the 21st, we're going to capitalize on technology and do it as a webinar to the Hazard Planning Committee to lay down the process that's going to be needed. And the consultant will give each of the jurisdictions some homework to do to go out there and look at what are their risks and how to catalog them and provide information back to them. After that, there will be two more meetings where they'll look to put together some strategies to reduce those risks. There'll also be opportunities when we have a draft plan. We're going to put it out to the public and get their inputs on it, take those inputs, and finally finalize the plan. After that, it goes on up to State Homeland Security and then to FEMA to be reviewed and approved at their levels.
So people need to find out what committees are being formed for input at their local levels.
Exactly. We want this to be a very local process, because what McCallsburg faces when it comes to hazards and risk is much different than what Cambridge. One's got the Skunk River flowing through it. The other one doesn't have any major river flowing through it. So those are the reasons why we want this to be a very local process. And also because if there are new ordinances that need to be put together or funding put towards some of these projects, it's the locals that are going to have to do these processes.
And this is for Story County. Some of our listeners don't live in Story County. We serve a wider area of central Iowa. Do you know, and you may not know the answer to this, is similar work being done in the other counties?
It is. We've reached this point here, though, where putting together these plans can be expensive, and some of the counties are going to have to decide whether they want one that is FEMA approved, which takes a lot of time and effort, or they may just do this process internally and meet a level that the state requires, which is less than what FEMA. I do know that, for instance, Dallas County is working through the process. Polk County will be working through the process. As a matter of fact, we've got Sheldahl that's on the counter on the corner of our county. Mm-hmm. One quarter of it's in Story County, a quarter of it's in Boone County, half of it's in Polk County. But we'll try and get them involved in ours so that they're covered by at least one of the plans.
And you said we've had a plan for at least the past 15 years or so. Can you give us an example of a situation that a hazard or an emergency that has arisen that you feel the community was better able to respond to because of this plan?
One of the key ones is, for instance, in places like Nevada, where they used to have housing down along the creek that runs through Nevada. By having plans like this, they were able to go in and buy out those houses and remove that kind of a threat. We've got tornado safe rooms in Gilbert, in Nevada, and we also have one that's attached to the middle school down in Huxley. So those students are in a much safer position when the sirens go off, because they've got some place that's designed to withstand winds up to 250 miles an hour.
And then once the plan is developed, how is it finally approved?
The plan is first off reviewed at the state level, and they may send it back, ask for some clarification. Then it goes on up to the FEMA level, gets lost in that bureaucracy for a while, and then comes back out. The consultant that we had last time did an excellent job, and they had just a few minor clarifications. The key point comes after that. Then it comes back down here into the counties, and each jurisdiction that participated at the front level has to adopt the plan as their own through a resolution. So Story City will have to pass a resolution within the city council meetings. The same thing for the school jurisdictions. They're going to have to, at one of their board meetings, go ahead and formally adopt the plan for it to be enforced.
Okay. And what I see in some of the notes you sent me, this phrase, staply. Could you explain what that is? S-T-A-P-L-E-E?
It's a great way to look at any project that you have to do or want to do that involves many different people that are coming together. We all know none of this stuff comes for free. If it did in terms of time, money, or effort, it probably would have been done long ago. So every one of these hazard mitigation strategies as they're being developed is scrutinized using that acronym STAPLE, which stands for examining the social aspects of it, the technical aspects of it, administrative, political, legal, environmental, and economic factors. And you go through each one of those and you rate them. And you 1 to 5, does this meet the social aspects of it? Will we find it socially acceptable? Some of these strategies aren't going to cover everybody. And, you know, that might be one of the things. Are we covering enough people for us to feel that we're doing the greater good for everybody? The administrative stuff. Once you put this plan into place, who's going to go out there and test this piece of equipment regularly? Do we have the administrative capability to do it? Is it legal? So if you look at each one of those, you'll have probably a lot more strategies than you'll have time, money to do. And then through this evaluation, both compared to the risk and the STAPLE, then you decide which ones you're going to put your time and effort towards.
So it's kind of a guiding mechanism of things that need to be considered.
And it's a checklist to make you really think through, think hard about both the short-term impact and long-term impact and benefits for each of these. Every hazard mitigation plan or project that's put into FEMA, they always do a cost-benefit analysis on it. So this is part of that, looking at all of those costs that, again, short-term and long-term, and being able to answer the questions.
What kind of roadblocks do you often come up against in doing this work at the different levels?
Again, with emergency management in general, it's an insurance policy. And just to put the time and effort into it, people look at it and say, it's not worth it until after the events happen. And then it's too late. If we don't get this plan done properly now, when we need it later on down the road, it's too late to go back and do it and be able to capitalize on some of that FEMA project money, or just getting it done and protecting our people before the disaster happens. So it's that, well, it'll never happen here kind of philosophy. After that, again, there's always going to be competing interests talking about trying use, land use kind of projects. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes to be told that they can or can't use their land for something, or it's not a good idea to use their land for something because of the risk that's involved in it. So oftentimes there are a lot of tough choices and discussions that have to go on.
Do those efforts ever end up in legal situations?
Fortunately, we haven't had that happen yet, but they could pretty easily, especially if you, again, are doing anything that restricts the use. An example of that is flood zone projects that are out there. There is regulation if you're going to do anything in the flood zone, because what you do upstream can definitely impact those downstream. But those that have ever had to try and work in the flood zones understand that oftentimes it does create conflict when you're trying to do something that isn't right in front of you and easily quantified.
The subject of water quality is getting a lot of press in Iowa right now. Is that a hazard that you would consider in this project?
Not so much water quality, but some of those items that are done to improve water quality can also help mitigate the chances of flooding. Retaining the water so that it doesn't flow as quickly into a river. As you know, our Skunk River is very volatile. And if there's any way that we can slow that water moving in to the Skunk River, we'll reduce the crest down later on. Those same kind of techniques, though, do tend to be helpful when it comes to filtering out some of the sediments and contamination. So there can be a dual purpose when it comes to those kind of activities.
But you don't look at that specifically?
No. Uh-uh.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So remind us again how people can get involved and what you would like community members to do.
First off, I'd like them to, again, reach out to their city clerks to and ask the question, are we involved in the hazard mitigation planning process? And if so, how do I become involved locally, get my inputs to our representative to the hazard mitigation plan? They can give our office a call. My phone number is 515-382-7315, or they can send me an email. It's kmorgan at storycountyiowa.gov, and that's all spelled out, all one word, .gov. And we'll try and put you in contact with whoever your representative might be in your community.
Well, thanks, Keith, for coming in, and we always learn a lot when you stop by.
Thanks. Appreciate you having us.
I've been speaking with Keith Morgan, the coordinator of Story County Emergency Management. And this is KHOI Community Radio. You've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Thanks to Marsha Schouten, members, saxophonist from the Heath Allen Band, and, of course, Keith Morgan. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard These Boots Are Made for Walkin' by Nancy Sinatra. It's February, and that is a very good time to become a member of KHOI. You can go to our website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button. Or you can call 515-292-2878 or come by the station and make a donation in person. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.